My name is Sally Steenland, and I direct the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative here at the Center for American Progress. With me today is Reverend Angela Herrera, who is the Associate Minister of the First Unitarian Church in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Angela is a longtime organizer and activist on reproductive justice and maternal health issues. She's also a member of our Faith and Reproductive Justice Leadership Institute here at the Center. Most recently, Angela worked with a coalition to defeat the 20-week ban on abortions in Albuquerque, and there her Spanish-language statement of faith-based pro-choice advocacy appeared on Univision. She has worked as a birth doula and completed a chaplaincy internship at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts, and that's where she was earning a master's degree from Harvard Divinity School. So those are a lot of accomplishments and a lot of activity, and welcome, Angela. We're so glad you're with us today.
Thank you.
My first question for you has to do with this weekend, this past Sunday, where you preached at your church and you preached a sermon on religious liberty. And you did that in anticipation of a Supreme Court argument, which is next week, actually a week from today, that the Supreme Court will be hearing. And it's about granting religious liberty to corporations based on a lawsuit by an arts and crafts store called Hobby Lobby and another corporation called Conestoga Woods, whose owners are refusing to include contraceptive coverage in the health care plans for their employees. And this is under the Affordable Care Act. So why did you preach that sermon? And tell us what you said.
Well, I preached the sermon because I wanted my congregation to know that although the media has been pitching this case as though it were a showdown between religious liberty and women's health, in reality, it's not about those things at all. In fact, those two things go hand in hand. And I wanted my congregation to know that what this case is really about is whether the government will give preference to the religious liberty of a corporation over the religious liberty of that corporation's employees. In other words, whether they'll allow the CEOs and owners of companies to dictate the level of access that their employees have to contraception based on the CEO or owner's religious claims. So I'm worried about that. And I'm worried also because that would affect not just the employees, but also female partners and adolescent daughters of employees, too. And I especially wanted my congregation to know that there are real-life consequences if the court decides in favor of Hobby Lobby, and that would actually be a blow to religious liberty. So as a faith leader, I care a lot about religious liberty, and I want to make sure that everybody has it and not just people in power or just a few people.
You know, I heard somebody say last week they were talking about this case, and they said that if the government rules in favor of Hobby Lobby, religious liberty could become a luxury item for employers and not for employees. And it seems that's what you're saying, that everybody gets religious liberty and not just employers.
That's right. That's right. I care a lot about this. And, you know, religious liberty is under threat right now, but it's not under threat by the Affordable Care Act. It's under threat by corporations like Hobby Lobby that want to impose conservative religious restrictions on tens of thousands of other people.
And one of the things you did in your sermon was you connected this Supreme Court case on contraceptive coverage to a recent veto of an anti-discrimination bill in Arizona by Governor Jan Brewer. And I think in a lot of people's minds, those two aren't connected, but in your mind, they are. And I would say in my mind, they are, that they're virtually about the same issue. And why did you bring the two together?
Well, it's really interesting because in both cases, what we have essentially are business owners claiming that their business should have religious liberty, which is a pretty radical thing to claim. I mean, if you think about it, businesses, I asked my congregation, actually, you know, who here would identify themselves as a corporation? And of course, no hands went up.
Sure.
Because corporations don't go to church, you know, and they're not religious nonprofit organizations like a church or a religious charity is. And so, so therefore they are not entitled to religious liberty. And in both cases, if we give religious liberties to a business or corporation, that will have an impact on a lot of people that depend on the business or corporation. And so it is favoring, in both cases, it's favoring a non-existent religious liberty of a corporation or business over the very real religious liberty
Sure.
of the people that depend on it.
You know, I've been talking to some clergy and some faith leaders, and you yourself are a clergy person. And one thing they've said to me, which I think is pretty persuasive, is that granting religious liberty to corporations is actually bad for religion because you know, churches and houses of worship and religious institutions, they have a rich history in our country of very valuable work in terms of social justice work, merciful work, and they're not out to make a profit. And if you take those special rights and privileges that historically have been reserved for this unique group of religious institutions, and then you just apply it, you just say, okay, to all businesses, everybody engaged in commerce, hey, you get this too, that's almost debasing religion and the meaningful role it has in our country.
I agree. Yes, we should not conflate religious nonprofits with corporate for-profit enterprises.
Yeah. You know, one of the things you said in your sermon that I liked a lot was you said the voices of women in this case around contraceptive coverage have been pretty silent. We haven't really heard women's stories. And then you told a story. Do you want to tell that story?
Sure. I'd be glad to tell that story. It's funny because, it's such a personal story. It's not a story I would usually tell from the pulpit at all. But it's so relevant to this case, and it's a story that people haven't heard because women's voices have been strangely absent from the public conversation. And so the story I told was a story that took place in 1999, back when I was a part-time student and the mother of a three-year-old and a new infant. There was a moment when my husband and I experienced a birth control failure. And so I won't go into much detail except to say that we immediately knew that we were in trouble. So I called the midwife who had delivered my son just a few months earlier, and she called in a prescription for me. And this wasn't a prescription for the abortion pill, but a prescription for a dose of hormones to prevent pregnancy from occurring at all. So first thing the next morning, I got the kids up, fed, dressed, buckled into the car, and I booked it down to the pharmacy right when they opened, because I know that the sooner you take the pills, the more effective they are. But when I got there, the pharmacist, who was like this big, kind of stern-looking guy in his 50s, informed me that he would not fill it because he thought it was immoral.
Wow.
So, I had an adrenaline surge. I couldn't believe that he was saying that. I couldn't believe it could be possible that he would have the right to cause a delay that could get me pregnant. I was furious. And I instructed him to just transfer it to the next closest pharmacy because I had wanted to just get that taken care of. And so I did go to the next one. It was 4 miles down the road. You know, luckily I had a car. Luckily my kids were healthy enough to lug across town. Luckily I didn't have to hurry into a job that day. Luckily the next pharmacist did fill it, because if any of those things had gone wrong, I could have had my third baby in 4 years. And I told my congregation, you know, if that had happened, then what? Would I have been able to continue on with my studies, which led me to a scholarship at a university, which led me to a scholarship and admission at graduate school at Harvard, which led me to be their minister? You know, would I even have been standing up there that morning? And, you know, I really couldn't say with certainty that I would. And it was all because of a pharmacist disagreeing with my midwife's prescription and asserting his religious liberty in a way that just barged right into the most private part of my life.
Well, and you're right. It was essential health care for you, but it was also your moral discernment and your religious liberty with your husband in terms of what was right for the flourishing of your family. And you made a very responsible decision, and somebody tried to thwart that.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that's happening here is the religious liberty of people who believe in restricting options is trying to dominate people whose religion allows for many options and who want to be the authors of their own lives and who deserve to be.
Right. And I think, you know, sometimes people spend a lot of time talking about the free exercise of religion. I have the right to exercise my own religion, and that's true. And there are many cases where doing so doesn't impose a burden on a third party. So if you want to wear a headscarf to work or a yarmulke or a whole variety of religious practices, that's fine. And that doesn't impose hardship or trouble or burden on a third party. But what you're talking about does. So the pharmacist's claim of religious liberty imposed real harm and burden on you. And so that's where you've got to, that's where it's not an absolute, because then you're being forced to follow his religious beliefs that are not your own.
That's right. That's right. You know, there are two sides to religious liberty. You know, on the one hand, it's the freedom to practice your religion. And on the other hand, it's the freedom to have it imposed on you by the government or other people.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's where that line has to be drawn. We say that there's a saying that one person's religious liberty has to end at the tip of another person's nose.
Right.
And that's what did not happen that day. His religious liberty did not end at the tip of my nose. It barged right into my life.
It punched you in the nose.
Yes.
It tried to punch you in the nose.
Punched me in the gut that day.
Punched you in the gut. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for preaching that sermon and for sharing your story, because I think it is very important to hear those voices. I want to go back in time to last year. I want to talk about the 20-week abortion ban that was proposed in Albuquerque. It was, I think, by many considered like it was going to pass. There was a coalition called Respect Albuquerque that you were part of, and you defeated it. And you, as a faith leader, was part of that coalition. Can you just talk about what was the role of faith voices in that coalition? And then for other groups, because we know 20-week bans are being proposed in other states, is there anything you learned that's worth sharing with groups that might be undergoing a similar effort?
Sure. Excuse me. Well, you know, it was absolutely crucial for people of faith to speak up, and not just me, but lots of other faith leaders, too. And it brings balance to the conversation, because too often the faith perspective on issues of abortion is really dominated by the anti-choice side, when in reality, millions of people of faith, including ministers and rabbis and priests, understand very well that the decision to end a pregnancy is an intensely personal one, and it has to be between a woman and her doctor, in consultation with her family and her faith. So when that referendum came to Albuquerque, my colleague here at First Unitarian and I joined other faith leaders in town in getting out in front of the issue. And some of the things we did to help the effort were hosting a press conference here at our church, going to rallies and workshops, speaking out from the pulpit and on social media. And we lent our church campus as a base camp for the coalition that was working to defeat the referendum. I think that the existence of that coalition is one of the most important things, one of the most important takeaways or lessons from the referendum in Albuquerque, because what we had was a network of relationships between pro-choice and pro-woman, pro-family organizations that preceded the referendum. So people had already had some relationships with each other, so that when the referendum came, we were able to mobilize really quickly and speak with one big organized voice.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that was really helpful. You saw banners for that said Respect Albuquerque Women all over town, and it was such a positive message, and it was so clear that there were a lot of people behind it. I think it really helped the effort a lot.
So having relationships that exist prior to an effort is an important thing. So you know each other, you can mobilize, you can hit the ground running, and you're not building it as you're flying it. It sounds like what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I know that you did some press around the issue as well. And again, can you just talk a little bit about the stories you were trying to get out and what's important about that messaging in terms of sometimes what the press coverage is, especially around the 20-week ban, which, you know, our opponents see that, some of them at least see that as a winning issue because they talk about fetal pain and they see it as, you know, having more public support than some of the other restrictive laws and policies. So how did you push back against that and how did you be proactive?
Well, it was important for people to start thinking about this, not just as an abstract concept, because it is a very hard thing to think about. You know, abortions later in the term they are, that I don't like to think about it either. But when you hear the stories of real women who've grappled with it, you realize just how complex and painful and personal a decision it is. And when you hear the stories of real women, it becomes very clear that we cannot legislate morality in this case. There's just no way that you can account for, all of the situations people find themselves in which choosing to terminate a pregnancy is a perfectly moral choice and such a personal one. So getting real women's stories out there helped make the issue more concrete and personal. So that was really important. Opponents are really whittling away at reproductive rights by imposing, this again is related to the religious liberty laws, mm-hmm. in a big way. They're
sure.
imposing their religious restrictions on others' behavior. So, you know, whether it's the 20-week ban or the Hobby Lobby case or the laws in Arizona, if you pan back, it's kind of all of one piece, really.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're right. The way to get support for those restrictions is to not allow moral complexity and real life stories in, but to just make it very simple and to really keep real women out of the picture, because some of these stories, it's, you know, they're morally complicated. And when you find yourself in a situation like that, those, you know, those little simplistic scenarios really don't apply.
That's right. If you keep it black and white, it's easy to imagine that it wouldn't affect someone you know or someone you love, when the reality is this issue confronts women, all kinds of women.
Right.
You know.
I want to ask about outreach you did in the coalition and you yourself to Latino communities. Mm-hmm. So New Mexico and Albuquerque has a strong Latina population. And so those groups of women in those communities were important in defeating the ban. And so what did the outreach look like? And can you talk a little bit about the stake that Latina women have in these debates around reproductive justice?
Sure. Well, first let me just say, although my last name is Herrera, I myself am not Latina. But however, my daughter, my 18-year-old daughter, does identify as Latina. And it's important to me that her voice and the voices of other women like her are heard. And not just Latino women, but Latino men, too. You know, Latinos are a really fast-growing part of the electorate, and are changing the face of America. But their voices on reproductive justice have sometimes been ignored or silenced. There's this misperception that all Latinos and Latinas are Catholic and that they're therefore anti-choice, when in reality, Latinas and Latinos are really thoughtful people of faith, who value the right to make personal decisions in the context of a family and in consultation with their faith. But they have their own moral consciences and so voices that need to be heard, for sure. So I was concerned with making sure those voices were heard, as was the coalition Respect Albuquerque Women. And there was a strong presence of Latinas and Latinos in that coalition. A couple of the things I did when we hosted a press conference here at First Unitarian Church, I was asked to prepare a statement in Spanish, and so I did. And I didn't just translate my English statement into Spanish. I did some research about what the proper language is, and you know, some of these things are hard to translate. And then I delivered a statement in Spanish that was picked up by Univision here in Albuquerque in New Mexico. And then the other thing I did, I went on our local public radio station and did a show called Voces Feministas, or Feminist Voices, which is a show for Latinas and everyone else in the Albuquerque community. So I spoke to the issue there in English as well.
And the participation of the Latina community was very important, is what it sounds like, in terms of getting out the vote and defeating the ban.
Absolutely. And also, when Respect Albuquerque Women was using our campus as a base camp for their outreach, they were doing some phone banking from our social hall. I went in to volunteer for a few hours, and I discovered that there was no Spanish language script. And, you know, probably half of the numbers I was calling, I was getting Spanish speakers. And so I quickly came up with a script that they could use,
too.
Oh,
that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. I want to switch. Let's fly across the country quickly here and go from Albuquerque to Boston. Mm-hmm. And you worked as a birth doula.
Yes.
And so that's a real life experience that's different from preaching and advocacy. But I could imagine that those experiences would feed your work theologically and in terms of advocacy as well. So mm-hmm. So what did that real life experience? How did that shape you and what you're now doing?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, being a birth doula was such a wonderful experience to give me a chance to walk with women taking diverse approaches to childbearing. And so, you know, my job was one part educating, but the other part companioning. And so whatever their choices were for their labor and birth and how they were going to parent their newborn baby, I was there to support and honor them and cheer them on in making thoughtful decisions that suited them. So it was, in many ways, of a piece with my reproductive justice work, which is about honoring the personal choices of women and their moral reasoning. But it was a great way to experience a diversity of women and to enjoy honoring their unique paths.
So my last question builds on that. When you were talking about reproductive justice encompassing women having children and mm-hmm. building families, as well as broader issues of health care, you're one of the participants in this wonderful Faith and Reproductive Justice Leadership Institute that we have this year. And in that institute, the words faith and reproductive justice are connected, and they're only separated by the word and. And mm-hmm. so what's the connection for you? Because so often those are seen as opposed.
Oh, I think faith and reproductive justice should always be connected with the word and. You know, as a mom, a doula, a person who works for reproductive justice, a faith leader, I know that the possibility of having children is just one of the most amazing parts of creation. Absolutely a gift from God, not something to be taken lightly or forced upon someone. And likewise, an established human life, the lives of individual women, are amazing gifts. And I want women to have the right to live into their lives fully, to be the authors of their own lives. And we can only do that with the full access to the full range of reproductive health options. So in my mind, as a faith leader, I work for reproductive justice because life is sacred.
Amen is what I say.
Amen.
Amen. Thank you. Thank you, Angela, very much. Thank you for talking with us. And thank you for the work that you do. It really is amazing.
Thank you for all that you do to support faith leaders in reproductive justice work.